Spirit of Design delves deep into the unseen elements of design and holistic sustainability.
Join us, Amy and
Anya,
for open conversations with creatives, scholars, activists, and others to envision alternative design futures that are diverse, inclusive, community-centric, and in symbiosis with all life on this planet.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Spirit of Design podcast. Here today, Amy and I are going to be chatting about visioning and real expansive visioning for the fashion spaces going forth. And it's been a little while since we chatted on here, right, Amy?
Yeah, a little while.
A little while.
I'm excited for today.
Yeah, really excited for this conversation. Some thoughts we've been having on more expansive and exploratory visioning for our collective fashion futures, for our collective design futures. And we've both been feeling like most of the visioning and futuring we've been seeing out there is very much based in this old paradigm. This old paradigm that we're trying to get out of and move away from. However, a lot of our visioning and futuring is still coming from the reality of what's possible based on our current systems and current paradigms, which we both feel we need to move beyond if we're going to create something different, create the sustainable world and the more beautiful world that we all so desire. So going to have a little bit of a chat around that today and pose some questions and go into some potential ideas and concepts and tools that we might be able to use to think more expansively, which I wonder if you agree, Amy, it can be so difficult to do because we're not taught to think in such huge imaginative exploratory ways anymore.
Yeah, I mean our education systems have taught us to think within certain confines, and our imagination hasn't really been valued in our collective society. So I think it's very hard for us to imagine things beyond this current paradigm, and like you said, a lot of the visioning that we felt we've seen is still within this current paradigm, still within the same money system, still within the same education systems. And there are tweaks here and there, but until we really look at the whole, until we're able to hold a vision that's so expansive, and I mean, you know, we're just imagining, and until we are able to have, until we give ourselves the ability to imagine beyond what is currently here, it's not even a possibility on the table. So yeah, I'm excited to have these conversations and to explore possibilities beyond what we've thought of or conceived of before. And yeah, it's going to be exciting.
And I think this is such a basis of what forms our work here, right? Imagining in more expansive ways the possibilities and then finding ways to bring that forth into the real world.
Yeah, 100%.
So, like I mentioned, we're so still stuck in this old current paradigm and system and that way of thinking and viewing the world. And of course we are, because that's how we're brought up. That's all this societal conditioning that goes generations and generations past us. And really to be able to start to envision and imagine in these more expansive ways of what is possible, it's really going to take us to rewire our minds and question our current beliefs and assumptions on how things ought to be done. Literally question everything and find new perspectives and opinions and thoughts around how we could push those beliefs and those assumptions. So Hayley Carr, who is an extraordinary coach and mentor, who I've been working with on a program this year, has just recently in our group, someone posed the question, how can I think bigger? How can I imagine more for my life? And this question, when this person posed, it just blew me away because I'm like, okay, well, this really relates to what we're doing. We are still very much stuck in this old way of thinking. So how can we think more expansively? So Hayley gave a few questions that we'd like to pose here that you might want to think about in a more fashion design context. So if we were already there in this desired future, what would we be doing differently than we are now? How would we be acting differently? What would we be saying? What would we be wearing? How would we be working? How would we be leading, etc.? And thinking about what we want, and this just blows my mind, what Hayley calls 10 times thinking. So thinking about what we want, how can we expand that by 10 times? 10 times better than what we're thinking. What about 100 times better? What about 1,000 times better? What would this ideal future look like when it is 100, 1,000 times better than we can even imagine it now? And that just blows my mind, right?
I think that's a really powerful question, because I think it's because we're so stuck in this way of thinking, we think in incremental changes. And of course, there's a process for anything to change, but the ability to even just imagine that kind of change, that kind of difference from where we are right now, is really powerful. Yeah. So I think these are really powerful questions to consider as we like move through this episode, and beyond there as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I almost feel like this visioning work, it's about asking better questions.
Yeah.
And more powerful questions, as opposed to thinking we need to have all the answers and all of this figured out, what it looks like, how we're going to get there.
Yeah.
As opposed to just asking more and more questions. And I learned this from one of my teachers in my master's program, Fashion Futures in London, and he was always just telling us, which I will never forget, ask deeper questions. It's about asking deeper questions, not about finding the solution. And at the time, that was kind of frustrating because we were all trying to figure out all the solutions to our issues within sustainable, within fashion, more sustainable solutions. And I didn't really get it at the time, but it's really starting to sink in that these issues and problems are so complex. And I think when we release control of trying to fix them and create these solutions, and more move towards asking better questions, then I think that actually gets us closer to the solutions, if that does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because I think it's broadening that scope of view, and even asking the questions can be so powerful, because if we are all collectively beginning to ask questions, it really, things begin to shift. Like, for example, even just thinking about money. Money is like a social construct. It's just a piece of paper that we assign value to. It's nothing. You can tear it up. You can burn it. It mostly exists online and in our minds now. And yet we've all agreed to that. And when we begin to question the agreements we've made around certain things, we then get to think beyond that, what we've accepted and what we've agreed upon, and make new agreements from there. But until we begin to question, or even, you know, have the conversation, there's no other possibility. It's not even within our frame of view, because we just accept it as being as is, if that makes sense. So yeah, I think asking questions is 100% where it all begins. And I really think that we've said this so many times, that imagination is so undervalued in our society. And literally we can't go anywhere else. If we can't imagine it, then it's not even possible. And so we have to begin by imagining other futures, and begin by actually making that something that's valued.
Yeah, it's almost like we need to reconnect with that childhood wonder and imagination, where you just let your mind explore possibilities, and no matter how ridiculous or how out there or how impossible they are, you know, when you're a child, you just do that. And we don't do that anymore, because we've been conditioned to believe things need to be a certain way and look a certain way, and only this is possible for me because of blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and the other thing kids do is they have this insatiable curiosity about them. Like they ask why. Why is it that way? What is, you know, what is this? Why is it that way? But why? But why? But why? But why? Like, I mean, I've got young children, and any mother of young children will tell you that the why question drives them crazy, because children will ask you why, and then you'll give an answer, and they'll say, but why but that? And then, but why that? And why? And we have, as we grow older, we accept so much that we forget to say why. Like, why is it this way? And I think that's, I think we need to revalue that, like put value back onto our own curiosity, our own questioning, and our own imagination. And so, I hope this conversation kind of sparks that. And I think there's a lot of things that, you know, will suggest that have come from our own imagining that aren't necessarily solutions or what we expect everybody else to believe or agree with, but are being suggested and offered up and shared as a way to get you to consider possibilities beyond our current paradigm, and hopefully start questioning and imagining in bigger ways as well.
Yeah, it feels exciting.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think that, we need to do it more. Yeah. We need to do it more, and we need to do it collectively more often.
Absolutely. So I wonder, like, going forward, based on that, let's maybe start to chat about these possibilities for fashion.
Yeah, let's do that.
Like for fashion design futures. And Amy, perhaps you were touching on before when we were speaking on these awesome new ways of thinking around money, and you mentioned it before, but fashion is so tied in with economics. How could this look?
I think one of the most brilliant visionaries that I've ever come across is Charles Eisenstein, and his book Sacred Economics. I found his work there to be profoundly visionary, in the sense that he's just thought the book itself is very dense and complex, and but he's really put together a vision for the future that is deeply considered and very well researched, and I loved it. But one of the points from the book that I really valued was his point about returning to the commons. And I wanted to read a passage from his book, Sacred Economics, because I thought it was really a good place to start on this conversation around money, because money is so tied into fashion. And so I'm just going to read this little passage from it. But it's from, I think, chapter 11, and it's called The Currencies of the Commons. He says, "We live on a naturally abundant planet, the source of life-sustaining gifts for us all. As observed in chapter 4, the planet's riches, soil, water, air, minerals, the genome, were created by no man and should therefore be the property of none, but held in common stewardship for all beings. The same holds for the accumulation of human technology and culture, which is the bequest of our collective forebears, a source of wealth that no living person deserves less than any other. But what to do with this realization? These truths are closely aligned with Marxist and anarchist critique of property, but the Marxist solution, collective ownership of the means of production administered by the state, does not reach deeply enough, nor does it address the real problem. The real problem is that in both the communist and corporate capitalist systems, a power elite makes and benefits from the decisions of how to deploy society's wealth. The convention of property, common or private, is used in both cases to justify and facilitate the allocation of wealth and power. The metamorphosis of human economy is underway in our time will go more deeply than the Marxist revolution, because the story of the people that it weaves won't be just a new fiction of ownership, but a recognition of its fictive conventional nature. What is property but a social agreement that a certain person has certain rights to use something in a certain prescribed ways? Property is not an objective feature of reality, and to reify it and make it into something elemental, as both capitalistic and communistic theory do, is to unconsciously enslave ourselves to a story that contains it. I do not think that a sacred economics can start with the ownership as an elemental property, because that concept buys into a worldview, a story of self and world that is not true, or that is true no longer. The discrete and separate self is an objective universe. So instead of saying, as a Marxist might, that the bequest of nature and culture should be collectively owned, let us cease applying the concept of property to these things altogether and think instead how to justify, creatively and beautifully embody their value in an economic system." That's it. But I think he's just really... The book made me question things in ways that I had not questioned before. And it made me think of money in ways that I had not thought of it before. And I love that he talks about returning land to the commons. And in the book, he talks about allocating certain limits of use of the commons. So, for example, you have certain pollution limits that you as a company can use. You pay for them. You pay for use of the commons and use of resources, energy, etc. And then companies, and then that money goes into organizations and people who are looking to regenerate those commons. And companies that reduce their burden are able to minimize the burden that they put on those commons and the resources that they use, the energy that they use, things like that, are able to reduce their operating costs. What I love about this idea is that it's the polar opposite of what we do currently in fashion, which is that the more you produce, the cheaper things get. And so we're overproducing to crazy amounts with the way we view resources and property and ownership means that we are not taking responsibility. We're not held responsible to the collective. And so I love this book. I think it's something that everybody should read and consider, just as an, even if you didn't agree with everything in it, just to expand your ideas and your understanding of money and what's possible. Because I think it's, money is at the crux of everything. The reason we produce so much is for money. The reason, you know, everything spins around money. And so, and all of the problems in the fashion industry can be traced back to money. And so I think if we really want to talk about systemic change, we need to also talk about money and how we use money and how money works and the agreements we have around money. And yeah, I think it's, I don't know, I think that book's a powerful place to start if you've never questioned the way money works.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, wow, it does make you completely think differently about what our systems could look like when we have a different relationship to economics, but also like this insatiable Western capitalist need to own, own land and things. And I guess it also delves into these power hierarchies that we have, and pretty much imagining new what power could look like in a more reciprocal and even and regenerative way that isn't about ownership and hierarchies.
Yeah, I find that concepts of ownership and money a little bit strange. Like, obviously I participate in the mainstream, but on the other hand, being Indigenous, our land's held in commons. The way we think about our cultures are traditionally gifting economies, and within Māori culture, that still plays a huge role. Everything still, not in all situations, obviously, because we definitely have been colonized and brought into the Western way of thinking. But when you return home to the marae and when you talk about land, it's all held in commons, and it is, and marae life definitely revolves around gifting economy and helping each other. And so I've seen it in practice. And yeah, it's interesting to consider what that could look like on a bigger scale, and how it could operate differently. Even when I was out at Ihumata last year for the protests here in New Zealand, we were occupying the land out there, and everything was based on gifting. They're feeding tens of thousands of people per day, 100% on a gifting economy. And there was no exchange of money. You would bring something to gift. So you would come in with bread or blankets or whatever. Everything was gifted. And it was on a relatively large scale. I mean, these are tens of thousands of people that were coming through at the peak of everything, being fed every day, three meals a day, all on gifting economy. And of course there's nothing is ever perfect, but it is possible. And so it's interesting to think about what happens if we were to, like you said, with Haley Carr's questions, what if you were to 10x a gifting economy or 100x a gifting economy? What could it look like if we operated differently, if we were dependent upon each other? What if the way we saw ourselves as individuals changed and we were more dependent upon each other? Would that change, you know, the way we do things, the way we do business, the way we operate?
I love that. And I'm having visions come to my mind right now of shared commons land that is cultivated for different materials, but also shared with people that are growing it for food. So different businesses and brands can come in and take only as much as they need and then give back. And it's like this beautiful reciprocal dance with the land, never taking too much, but then it really gives an opportunity also for small businesses and brands to have access to supply chain materials. And then maybe the same could be done with production. So you have these production units perhaps in every city, and that's also held in the commons.
Yeah, and that, I mean, wouldn't that change everything? Because your responsibility as a business would be to the commons. And you would be paying for what you take. You'd be paying for the way that you pollute and the impact you have on the commons. That would, you would be responsible directly to that community, to your community and to the commons. And so wouldn't that change how things work right now? Because at the moment it seems like, well, it doesn't seem like, but you know, businesses are using far beyond what is even necessary for them to be using, because there's so much wastage and they're held in responsibility to nobody because of the way that politics works, because of the murkiness of our supply chains and all of that kind of stuff. So much is just being wasted and nobody is being held responsible. But what if we were held responsible to each other and to the commons and to the collective? Yeah. It just is such a radical shift in the way we think. But it also, I feel like participating in an economy that, you know, has shared commons changes the way we feel about ourselves and changes the way we feel about each other, changes the way we feel our own purpose in life. And I think that's healthy. I think that's, I think everybody can benefit from that. And it's, for some, it would be such a huge shift in thinking. And it would seem like such a huge loss, but actually money's not everything. And the way that we operate at the moment, everything is about money and profit and scalability. And I feel like we need to shift from that into relationality with each other and relationships and valuing our relationships with each other and with our natural world. And yeah, I don't know. It's very interesting to imagine what it could look like beyond that. And I love those ideas that you shared about common shared, land that is farmed, for fibers and for food. And it's just, that's such an exciting idea to me. A really exciting idea to me. So what I want to ask you this question, because I see it sitting here and I feel like it's gonna take us down a very exciting track. So I'm gonna ask you this. But what does fashion or design look like for you when it goes beyond creating more things?
Oh, I love this question. And I think it's actually touching on what you just mentioned. It's about relationality. It's about relationships and building community. And yes, we will be making things. That's part of that process. But that's, I feel like that's not really the main the main thing going on, or that could be going on when we're talking about fashion. And I think design is doing this better at the moment. Fashion's still lagging behind in terms of it being about a material culture that is focused on relationships, on building community, on cultivating care towards the land, one another, but also to ourselves. And I think it really excites me, the possibilities of what our making culture could look like when it is focused on the interconnections in between, not these end goals, which we see at the moment at a commercial stage. It's about, you know, making stuff, the whole supply chain within. In between is kind of forgotten about, same predominantly with food, although it's food's more ahead than clothing. You know, we don't see everything that's happening in between. It's about this end product to make as produce as much so people can consume as much as possible to gain as much profits. But what if it actually was about cultivating those relationships and those interconnections in between? Building relationships with the makers, with the growers, with the designers, with the artisans, and really focusing on that, and then the products, the garments, the technologies, the systems that arise out of that are just a beautiful energetic byproduct of those relationships. That really excites me.
And when you were speaking about that, like the thing that came up for me was like how we, this is maybe slightly tangential, but how we segregate our lives into like our work life and our private life. But what if our lives just became like work was just a part of who we were and a part of our expression today, if that makes sense, so that I kind of see it as we have private lives where we have relationships and friendships, but what if our work was all intertwined and we kind of took ourselves out of those boxes and allowed ourselves to be so in the joy of the creative process and design process that it was about taking time to build those relationships and genuinely caring and fostering those relationships in a way that we haven't possibly done yet as a, in a broader sense. Yeah, I don't know. That's where it took me. Mm-hmm. Sorry, it was a bit of a tangent. Yeah. Started thinking about, yeah, how we have these two sides of ourselves and we don't like them to touch. But what if they did touch? What if they were supposed to touch? What if it wasn't, there wasn't supposed to be boxes for everything? Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it would be very different.
We love to compartmentalize in the West, and I think that's been one of the biggest disadvantages that we've done to ourselves, but I think it's changing now.
I think so too.
And I think also going on from what you are saying, Amy, we don't allow ourselves the time because the systems that have been created, that we've created as a collective, don't allow this time for slowing down, for listening, for reflection, for introspection. It's quite, you know, we know this is a privilege for us to be visioning right now. Mm. We know that. It's when you barely can put food on the table, when you're surviving week to week, you can only think that day or that week ahead, maximum.
Mm.
So imagine if I guess this is where ideas around basic universal income come in, where if we were allowed that time and space as a collective to slow down and focus on building these relationships and this care, the different possibilities that might arise from that.
Mm. That's why I love the idea of the commons and, like you said, basic universal income, because I think if we had that basic universal income, we had the commons, which were shared, it brings us all up onto a more even playing field. And if we're on a more even playing field, it's so much harder for big companies to take advantage of people. Because you're willing to do anything when you're putting food on the table for your children so they don't starve to death. Of course, you know, people will do anything for that because you're talking about basic human rights, basic human needs. And so if those are unmet, then whatever is providing you the opportunity to meet those is able to take advantage in whatever way they see fit. And that's what we see with huge fashion companies and fast fashion. They're able to take advantage because there are so many people whose basic needs are going unmet. And so I think that idea of returning us to a baseline where, you know, our basic needs are met, where that's just a given, gives people the opportunity to think differently. I think it also means that there's a lot that's taken off the table. The overproduction, the slave labor, the minimum wages that just aren't providing anyone with what they need, all of that's taken off the table. It's not even a consideration anymore. And so for me, that's a huge yes. I think that would revolutionize, that in itself would revolutionize the fashion industry, just having, yeah, that basic universal income and the commons, land being returned to the commons.
Yeah. And I think what you mentioned is so on point around evening the playing field, because I think there's so many people that are already very ahead with how they're living their life and the opportunities they've been granted. And I feel like I'm one of those people, and so many people around me, but I know there's also so many people that are struggling and haven't been given those opportunities and can't even begin to imagine what alternatives can look like. But if everyone, particularly minority groups and disadvantaged people, people that have been left out of these conversations for so long, if that playing field was evened out, I think we would also see way more diversity within our systems.
Yeah. 100%. One of the things that I've thought about recently, which is just, it's just an idea to throw out there to think about the possibilities. It's not that I'm saying this is what we should do. But I was thinking about the hierarchies of fashion and how CEOs are making outrageous salaries. And I just wanted to play with the numbers to kind of look at and get a picture of what it could possibly look like, this kind of responsibility, if we were to put responsibility on these companies, not for paying slightly more to our garment workers, but just as an idea, attaching the salary of the CEO to the lowest paid person that works either within that company or for that company. So for example, attaching the salary of the CEO to the salary of a garment worker or a farmer, and having a percentage difference between them that can't be, that you can't go above. Just as an example, just try to explain what I mean. So I was looking at Carl Johan Pearson's salary for 2012. I could only find for 2012. He's the CEO of H&M, and in 2012 he earned $12.8 million in salary bonuses and other compensation. In Bangladesh, a garment worker currently, their average wage is less than $1,200 US per year. I was gonna say month, but it's year per year. And so when you look at the numbers and the difference between those, the CEO is making more than 10,000 times their yearly wage, the yearly wage of a garment worker. The garment worker is making 0.01% of his yearly wage. Even 1%, even if the garment worker was to make 1% of his yearly wage, it would be $128,000 per year versus $1,200 per year. So just this idea, just playing with the idea of attaching the CEO's salary to the garment worker's salary and saying the CEO, just as an example, it's just to think outside of the way we think right now. But just as an example, if you were only able to earn 200% more than the garment worker was as the CEO, fuck, you would seriously be considering paying the garment worker a hell of a lot more than what they currently earn, wouldn't you? Because, yeah. I don't know. It's just... thinking about things outside of the box. How do we create a sense of responsibility? Because currently most companies couldn't give a flying fuck. So how do we create a sense of responsibility? And also how do we like, if a CEO's salary is tied to a garment worker's salary, you're then as a CEO constantly thinking about what this person's making. And if you're living at a certain standard, which is 200% above what they're able to, you're also then thinking about what access they have based on the salaries that you're giving them. It immediately makes you responsible for their salary because you know what it is, because it's tied to yours. And so I don't know, just thinking about things differently when it comes to money and the hierarchies that are in fashion, I think is really an interesting thought.
Oh, I love that idea of tying like the garment workers or workers in general salary to CEOs. I think that's a really interesting concept. And I think it's also important to note that money per se isn't bad. Like it's just energy, like everything else. The problem is, and there's nothing wrong with making lots of money. It's the fact that, as you mentioned, you need to take radical responsibility for the people that are within your supply chain and within your business, and the massive, massive, massive gaps and disconnection to humanity and the environment, as well as the environmental cost. It's when those things are ignored, I think that's when the issue is, personally.
Yeah, 100%. There's nothing wrong with making money. And as you said, it's just energetic. But when it's at the, when you're making money directly off of somebody else's suffering or somebody else's disadvantagement, then that is just wrong. Most of the time that money is made off of the degradation of an environment, which somebody else who is much less well off than you are lives in and has to suffer the consequences of, and on the backs of people who are being paid just enough to keep them in the job, but not enough to demand more than what they're, you know what I mean? Just to keep them there. And so, yeah, that's the issue. The issue is never the money. And if it, you know, if it was really about equality and not about the money, then you could be making that much and giving away 1% of your salary so people can live a, you know, live in a way where they could feed their children, educate their children, clothe their children, and have opportunities for themselves, ability to save, ability to, you know, house oneself. It has nothing to do with that, though.
I think this is where this idea of collective futures ties in. And when we're imagining and envisioning, how can we actually envision and imagine futures where we're rising up together, where no one is left behind, where everyone has this even playing field? And what the hell does that look like? What the hell could that look like? And we haven't seen it before in this capitalist society. So, nor in communism, as you were quoting Eisenstein. And so I think it's really exciting when we allow ourselves to imagine what this could look like when everyone rises up. And that really requires us to get out of our collective, also induced by capitalism, scarcity mindsets, that there isn't enough for everyone to go around, which is a bullshit idea.
That's one of the biggest issues I have with this conversation around representation and inclusion in fashion, because it's not possible within our current paradigm. Inclusion depends upon the includer to include you in the system, and the power balance still lies with the includer, not the included. And so until the playing field is evened out, until we have something like a basic universal income, until we have a commons, which is, you know, our land is held in commons for everybody's benefit, mutual and, you know, equal benefit, then these conversations around representation and inclusion are just about making people look better on paper, but it's not genuinely about partnership, which is, I think, where we need to shift into. And when we even the playing field, it becomes about partnership because people have choice. When you have choice, you get to choose what you do and do not give your time to. When you're surviving, there's no choice there. It's just you're just doing what you need to do, and you'll take whatever opportunity you possibly can. And so we have to shift from that survival to all needs met, all basic needs met. So then it can be about choice and partnership rather than representation and inclusion, which is not at all about equality.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a big one. Another thing that I would love for us to touch on is, and I know both of us really want this, so perhaps we could have a little conversation about it, is really bringing back this balance between the spiritual and physical worlds for our future. And a quote we posted the other day from Braiding Sweetgrass from legendary Robin Wall Kimmerer. And she says, "I dream of a world guided by a lens of stories, rooted in the revelations of science and framed with an indigenous worldview. Stories in which matter and spirit are both given voice." And I just love this so much. And we've compartmentalized spirituality and science and as these two separate things, as well as the physical and the metaphysical. And what would our futures look like for design, for fashion, for futures in general, when the spiritual, energetic, metaphysical world is just a part of our normal day existence, when it isn't just relegated to this corner of our lives? And perhaps you could speak to this, Amy, too, but I know Indigenous cultures have been doing this, are still doing this, but in the West, it's so disjointed.
Yeah, and I think it's intentionally been disjointed for many reasons. But yeah, I think that when you have that balance, the way you perceive and see the world, the way you move within the world is very different. And our current paradigms can't operate if we are having that balance between the spiritual and physical worlds. Because we would be so aware of all the bullshit that goes on. Do you know what I mean? If you were able, and many of us can see, but if the general public was able to see what's going on in a spiritual sense in our physical world, there's a very good reason that we have been conditioned out of our ability to see what's going on, and that's so that the current agenda can keep going. That's so that things can continue to operate the way that they do. I think in a design and fashion sense, we would have a sense of responsibility, a profound sense of responsibility to each other and to the physical world. I think it would inform our work in a really deep way. But yeah, I don't know. I think for one, the way that we operate in our current Western paradigms to have got into this place, it was necessary that the spiritual be relegated to different, to the church or whatever. But if we want to shift into a more balanced world, then we're going to have to remove just question our ideas around spirituality and its place in our lives and what it actually means and yeah, it's been used as a tool for so long to colonize, to conquer, to, yeah, that I think it's become so warped in our understanding, and many of us decided that we want nothing to do with that because of the history of spirituality, especially when it comes to the West.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's already happening. There is such a huge reconnection happening with spiritual practices, and people are really searching. It's especially right now, it's like the veil has been lifted on a lot of aspects, negative aspects of our society, and people are reconnecting with themselves more and with these ancient practices and traditions, which is pretty cool. I think going forth into the future, what this looks like for me when I think about it is a real deep reconnection with these essences that we, the Western capitalist society, has undervalued. And they are quite feminine essences. And by feminine, I don't mean gender specific. We all have feminine and masculine within all of us, whether you're male, female, gender, non-binary. But these feminine essences, such as listening, such as intuition, such as reflection, such as reverence, reciprocity, these, and I could go keep going on, but these essences, these elements of our humanness and of our world that are undervalued, that we do not measure success by currently, because they are deemed as weak and that which cannot be measured or quantified. I think a reconnection to these aspects, which is already happening, but really, but more so 10 times more, 100 times more, 1,000 times more. And I'm really stretching my mind to think about what that could look like, but I would love to, because it has been thousands of years that we have been disconnected as a collective from those essences.
I think there's also an element, like for me, I feel like there's also in this balance and a place for the respect of our elders, like that elder wisdom and learning from our elders, that to me is a return to balance. Like, and just because someone is older doesn't make them an elder. There's a big distinction. So a return to learning from our elders, the wise ones. And I think also for me, that balance is and like you said, a lot of people are returning to their spirituality. There's just been this huge resurgence in the West of this huge, I guess, spiritual awakening that's been taking place. And I think to a degree, a lot of people have gone from one end of the spectrum to the absolute opposite. And we now need to come to the balance, the in-between. And for me, that balance looks like a place of non-judgment. And that balance between the spiritual and physical worlds is that realization that there are multi-truths. And that there's not just any singular way of doing things. There's not one singular way to be spiritual, not one singular right, not one singular wrong. And so I think in the context of fashion, returning to that balance is going to look like not always needing things to be this way or that way. Circularity is not the only way to do things. This is not the only way to do things. Does that make sense? So it's returning to that place of non-judgment and that balance and the recognition that there are multiple truths. I think when we return to that place, that for me is the balance. And there's many things that need to take place to get to that balance. But yeah, I don't know. To me, that feels like the balance.
I love that. And I think that ties in so nicely with this idea that there are multiple futures. There isn't just a future. It's plural. There's multiple futures, just like there's multiple truths.
Yes.
Which is why it's so important as well when we're doing this futuring and visioning work that it is collective work that makes room at the table for lots of diverse voices to self-represent, because otherwise we're just colonizing the future pretty much.
Yeah. And it's also very easy, like when if we go too far into one end of the spectrum, it's very easy to think that everybody needs to be the same, and we lose the value of cultural differences and value differences and things like that. It's very easy, and we've seen a lot of people within the spiritual space do it, where it's like we're all one and we're all equal, and therefore I'm entitled to everything you have. And I think that balance of being non-judgmental gives us all space to recognize each other as sovereign beings and recognize each other's experiences and cultures as being something that's brought you to the place you are as the person you are, with the purpose that you have as a unique individual who is part of a collective, who's part of a wider family. And I don't know, I think to come to that place of non-judgmental, like of acceptance of each other, of radical acceptance of each other, is that's the balance. And yeah, it's going to be very, yeah, I think we're moving in from either side. It's like there's both sides of the spectrum, and we're trying to find our balance in between. And yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey.
Yes, and, it is.
I also wanted to mention what we were chatting before the call around this idea around fluid identities and fluid genders, and really moving beyond that for our futures. And you had some beautiful reference points when we were chatting, Amy.
I recently listened to a podcast with The Conversations. I think it's Jason Campbell and Henrietta. I think I forgot her last name. That's awful.
We can
put the link in the show note. They had a conversation with Alok Vaid Menon, and Alok Vaid Menon was talking about, the conversation was about degendering fashion. Is degendering fashion the most pressing issue in fashion right now? And, they were talking about, how fashion is this, like gendered fashion is this social construct, is the same as money. We've agreed upon it, right? It's crazy to think that we've agreed that a skirt is singularly for the female identified, the female body, the female form, right? And it doesn't, and nobody else can wear that. It's not socially acceptable for anybody else to wear that garment. It's a complete social construct. It's something we've agreed upon, and it's not real. We can change our minds at any point. Same as for a long time, it was pink as being a female color and blue as being the male color, and all of this kind of social construct that we've created. But the question that Alok was posing was around degendering fashion, and would degendering fashion create a more fair, safe, and creative world? And I love that. I love what they were sharing in that conversation, and the way it was making me think differently outside of the way I'd thought before, because they were sharing perspectives that I had never considered before. And so I think it's an excellent resource to go listen to and to go check out. But can we question all of these agreements we've made that are not founded on reality, but are founded upon social agreements? And if they're not working for us, or if they're not working for some of us, if they put some of us in unsafe situations, can we choose something different? And in the case of gendered fashion, It is for many people putting them in unsafe situations to express themselves in the way that they would choose to. So can we make different social agreements about that? And so in thinking about visioning new futures that are fair and that are safe and that are creative and equal and, you know, are what we want, we also need to consider all of these social agreements that we've made and how they can be unsafe for some of us and for those of us who are privileged to never have even considered that it could be unsafe for somebody else. We have a responsibility to consider those social agreements we've made. Are those social agreements, because for me personally, that's not a social agreement I'm okay with. I don't ever want to participate in making social agreements that make somebody else safe or feel unworthy or feel like they're not safe to express themselves completely. And so, yeah, I think check it out. It's brilliant. And I think this is one of the huge questions we have to consider right now. What social agreements have we made? Because they are just fictions of our imagination. We can make new ones.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. With money, with all of it.
Oh, yeah. I think that just hits the nail on the head, where it's really, this work is about literally observing our current beliefs and assumptions about how things are done, about the world, and rewriting them, making new choices, new beliefs. And then that leads to these new systems and new paradigms. Because like we've mentioned a million times before, everything starts within each of us.
Mm.
So we really need to be doing that on an individual level first.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that it has to begin there. We have to have a willingness to actually go within and ask those questions of ourselves. And yeah, I think one thing that I love, like I just want to touch on before we go, one of these questions that I want to ask you before we sign off, because I don't know, I feel like it's a big one and I'm quite interested to hear what you have to say. But on the role of technology in our futures, do we want to keep glorifying technology as it has been within design so much? You know, and what does that look like as we move forward? What role does technology have to play moving forward?
This is a big one. And I'd love to know your thoughts on this too afterwards. I do think we need to, when we're envisioning and creating these new futures, we do need to stop glorifying technology as the savior. This techno-romanticism that technology is going to save us, that a technological solution is the answer. I think we need to be treating it as a beautiful, beautiful tool that can enhance our lives. And it has, you know, we're using it right now. We wouldn't be able to be doing this podcast otherwise. But I do think we need to be very critical and mindful of a lot of the advancements that are happening, particularly with the rise of censorship, surveillance, and so on, which we are seeing more and more of. Just yesterday, my friend posted a video on Facebook, which was showing an alternative perspective, some doctors speaking in America, which had already 30 million views, and that was taken down on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram. And that's just one of many examples of how our right of free speech is being kind of bridged upon through technology. So I think we need to be really critical and mindful of everything that's happening now, of how our data is used, where we pretty much have absolutely no rights anymore over if you're on the internet, pretty much all that you're posting is owned by the companies of the platforms that you're using, which is pretty wild. And there are many, many points we could discuss, but I won't go into them just now. But I think being critical and mindful, we need to imagine a future where technology is a tool, not the be-all and end-all. And I know there's a lot of futurists talking about technology or AI particularly really coming into being and even taking over humans at some point. And I think we need to remember that we have the power to choose. And with these technologies, there needs to be ethics and deep, deep ethics and morals considered when we're using and engaging and imagining futures. What do you think about this?
I mean, I agree with you completely. I think one of the things I think about technology is that it's like the new gold rush. Like everybody's out to make, you know, to find the gold first and to make the most amount of money. And so to me, that's very concerning because then ethics are very muddy. But I think talking about a vision for the future, I like what Charles Eisenstein says about technology, that human technology and culture is the bequest of our cultural, of our collective forebears, a source of wealth that no living person deserves less than any other. And so I think looking at technology as returning to the commons as well, because it is, even if you as the designer or creator of a certain program, say for example, create and design that program, you still, whether or not you, you might not have ripped that idea off someone directly, but it was the collective ideas of many other people who came before you that subconsciously or consciously informed how you created what you did. And therefore returning technology to the commons. And I think by returning technology to the commons also changes the way that we would interact with it, because governments and the whole surveillance and I guess the, what do you call it? I've just lost the word. When your
censorship
does it, the whole surveillance and censorship of, you know, the online spaces would, and physical spaces would change if technology was placed back in the commons, all technology. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. That's with technology, it's a complicated one, I think.
Yeah, and I think we're already seeing that happening to some degree with the blockchain. It's really the democratization of, which they're trying to do with money, with Bitcoin, Ethereum, etc. So perhaps I feel like the actual underlying concepts of blockchain technology is quite revolutionary in terms of our technological futures, because it is open source. It is a democracy. It's anyone can go in, and you aren't automatically having to be linked to big corporations, big banks, in how you make transactions. And I think that will be a huge part of our future.
There's a lot of open source stuff that there's a lot of stuff online that has become open source, but it's that, like, I would like to see in our future that big companies like Facebook and, you know, and governmental organizations and stuff like that, their use of technology has to become transparent. And that technology is also available for anybody else. Or gets taken off the table if we all agree that's unethical.
Which
I don't know. It's complicated, though. So many issues, and it's way more complicated than what I'm making it out to be. But I don't know. Technology is a very big one.
Mm. And I think it's also, like you mentioned, Amy, tapping into the technologies of our ancestors and reconnecting with those for the future as well, bringing in other technologies into our futures.
Yes. That word technology is very much been, I guess, what would you say? Is a very narrow definition of what technology is in the West. And it excludes any other culture's technologies that don't fit within that very narrow framework. Yeah, so I think also looking at what we define as technology so that it can be more inclusive. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that you wanted to add before we might finish up?
No, I didn't have anything else. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I feel like we've covered a lot. So it might be good to leave it there. It might be a conversation for another day, part two.
Amazing. We'll put all of the show notes with all of the, resources that we've mentioned and the questions that we've asked, so you can come back to it and go over them. And yeah, I would really encourage you to check out the resources that we've added on to the show notes because there's some brilliant ones that will really challenge you, even if you don't agree, but will really help you to think outside of our current paradigm.
So I hope everyone that this has given you a little bit of food for thought on how you could reimagine fashion or design or whatever field you're in or your life in general as a system of flourishing for all collectively. So thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you.
We'll see you soon. Bye everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this week's conversation.
For today's show notes, to get in touch or sign up to our mailing list, you can find links at the bottom of this episode page.
And if you are new to our community, then head on over to our Instagram at sustainability5.0 and our website www.sustainability5.world and follow along to stay up to date with our upcoming online and in-person events.
If you found value in today's conversation, then we would so appreciate it if you would subscribe and leave us a review. Through this, you're helping others to find these important conversations.
Have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.